Wholly inadequate reasons for going to war, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A new report blasts former British Prime Minister Tony Blair for going to war in Iraq based on wholly inadequate reasons. We'll get reaction from the mother of a British soldier who died in that war.
Still very, very angry. I'll be angry forever.
And we'll hear how Blair is seen in Britain because of Iraq.
There's just this feeling he was Washington's poodle and that he rushed Britain into an unnecessary war on the side of a crazy American president.
Plus, former Colombian politician and hostage Ingrid Betancourt on what peace could mean for her country.
It's a huge, huge event for all of us. I've never seen my country in peace.
All that and more today on The World. Thank you for being here. It was the hardest, most momentous, most agonizing decision he made as British Prime Minister. So said Tony Blair today about his decision to join the US-led invasion of Iraq in 2003.
For that decision today, I accept full responsibility, without exception and without excuse.
Blair's comments followed the release today of a British government report, 7 years in the making. It's called the Chilcot Report, and it's a devastating critique of the British government's intervention in Iraq. It called the preparation for war wholly inadequate and the justification for it far from satisfactory. The former prime minister said today he stands by his decision to help the U.S. topple Saddam Hussein. He also apologized for his mistakes.
I know there are those who can never forget or forgive me for having taken this decision, and who think that I took it dishonestly. As the report makes clear, there were no lies. Parliament and Cabinet were not misled. There was no secret commitment to war. Intelligence was not falsified, and the decision was made in good faith.
Former Prime Minister Tony Blair's remarks today after the release of the Chilcot Report. Among those who can't forget are Christine and Peter Brierley. Their son Sean was a Lance Corporal and died serving in Iraq in 2003. I first asked Christine what she thought about Tony Blair's statement.
He's a liar. I don't believe a word he said. I don't believe he's as sorry as he says he is. He should never have done what he did. He should never have gone to war without the UN backing behind him.
The report doesn't go so far as to say that the war in Iraq was illegal, but it does state pretty clearly that the way the decision was made in the UK to find a legal basis for the war was far from satisfactory. As the mother of a British soldier who lost his life in that war, where does that leave you and your emotions?
Still very, very angry. I'll be angry forever. Tony Blair's son should have gone to war. He should have gone and taking the chance that my son took, that my son believed it was protecting us from Saddam Hussein and the weapons of mass destruction. I'll never, ever forgive the man for what he did.
Do you feel Tony Blair committed a war crime?
Yes, I do. He didn't wait for the UN to say yay or nay. He knew 8 months before that they were going to war. He knew that they didn't have enough equipment and it's just wrong. They should never, ever have been there. He chose to send them.
Without a clear judgment, though, as to whether Mr. Blair did something illegal, what can you and your husband do legally?
We did go to the European Court of Human Rights, and it cost us quite a lot of money, but we actually lost. But if it comes to it and we can take him to court, I'm sure my husband will.
That's Christine Brierley. I also spoke with her husband, Peter, who was in London for the release of the Chilcot Report. Like his wife, he didn't think much of Blair's statements today.
It's too little, too late, because he's doing again what he's done before. He's part apologising and saying, but it wasn't me. So I'm afraid I can't accept his apologies. He needs to be put in front of a court and he needs to be tried.
So you and your wife, Christine, would like to take Tony Blair to court. Do you feel he committed a war crime?
I feel that every time he opens his mouth, he admits a war crime, because we've seen the legal advice for going to war. And one of the things that you can't go to war for regime change, from day one, from the day they first went in there, he said, I have removed Saddam. We have removed an evil man. the fact that they were an evil man is quite, in my opinion, quite true. But unfortunately, legally, you can't remove him. So he has committed a war crime because he has admitted it himself every time he opens his mouth about Saddam.
Without a clear judgment, though, in the UK as to whether Mr. Blair did something illegal, what can you and your wife do legally?
Well, there's all sorts of things we can do, but it's not only me and my wife. There are a large group of us, Military Families Against the War. We have engaged a solicitor, and one of the things that I've said things about the report, but the truth about the report is it's a massive report. With the other parents and with the legal team that we've got working with us, we need to go through it, and we will find something that, as a group, we can take Tony Blair to court. And it may well be not the war crimes court. We may not be able to get him abroad, but there must be something he's done. Because he lied. He lied to Parliament. He lied to people. He lied to everybody to get what he wanted.
Peter Brierley, could you tell me a bit about your son, why he wanted to join the military, and what he thought his deployment to Iraq would achieve?
My son wanted to join the army to start with, from being 2 years old. My brother were a soldier who'd served in Northern Ireland, and him and Sean got on really well. Sean loved him. So Sean wanted to be a soldier from when he were two. As kids grow up, I mean, it's probably the same in America as it is here. When kids grow up, they go through a phase, they want to be a fireman, they want to be a policeman, they want to be an astronaut. Sean never, ever wanted to be anything but a soldier.
Mr. Brierley, really appreciate your time. Again, our condolences for your loss.
Thank you.
One of the main conclusions of the Chilcot Inquiry was that going to war in Iraq was not the last resort. In other words, it was a war of choice for Britain. Stephen Erlanger spent years in the Middle East for the New York Times, and now he's their London bureau chief. He says the invasion was also a war of choice for the U.S. and President George W. Bush.
To be honest, President Bush had the choice of letting Hans Blix really do a serious investigation and inspection of Saddam's weapons of mass destruction. But by January of 2003, it was quite clear even to the British that Mr. Bush was about regime change, that it then became an issue of trying to find the right legal reason to go to war. So they came up with weapons of mass destruction. But there was no question in my mind, at least, that Saddam was a threat to his own people. But was he a threat to the world, blowing up the world? That was far less clear.
What does it matter if this was a war of choice?
Well, it mattered because of its consequences. I mean, I think in the end, it broke this notion that started with Bosnia and Kosovo, and that Blair also had with Sierra Leone, that somehow the West was obligated to create a new world order and to overthrow dictators all over the place. And I think, you know, this was hubris. Nobody really had the time, the money, or the patience. I mean, it was easy to win the war, as we all know what happened afterwards. I think it will be with us for quite some time. And that's the problem with the war of choice. I mean, the question always was, if you just left Saddam to brutalize his own people, would he then, down the road, try to get another system of weapons of mass destruction going? And the Blair judgment, and I guess the American judgment, was yes, he would, so better to take him out now. But I think, you know, in retrospect, and probably at the time among top American officials, certainly that was a pretext rather than a firm conclusion.
If I can put a shorthand on all of what you said, you're basically saying today is a bad day for Tony Blair, but maybe only his worst day ever, and from now on he'll have to battle internally.
I think that's true. I mean, he's widely detested in Britain. There's just this feeling he was Washington's poodle and that he rushed Britain into an unnecessary war on the side of a crazy American president. That's the view here, and I don't think he'll ever be forgiven.
It seems there's more anger in the UK over Blair taking the ride to Iraq with Bush and less anger here in the US with Bush as the driver of the car that went to Iraq. Why do you think that is?
It's a very good question. I've thought about it myself because actually, you know, 179 British soldiers died, including, you know, the son of the man you spoke to. And in a cold way, that's not a huge number. But there was a sense of wasted lives. Now, why there isn't more uproar and anger in America, it's hard to say. I think 4,500 American soldiers have died. I don't really know, but I'm surprised there isn't more in America. And I'm a little surprised at the intensity of it in Britain.
So, final question. This Chilcot inquiry comes out and says Blair and company didn't have the plans to even make the invasion work and that it was a war of choice, essentially. Meantime, here in the U.S., you've got Donald Trump praising Saddam Hussein for killing terrorists. What was this war all about? I mean, that feels like the question today.
I'm not sure I'll let, you know, Donald Trump decide the judgment of history, though he's entitled to say what he likes.
Yeah.
What was the war about? The war, to me, again, this is very personal. I, you know, maybe shouldn't say it, but I think it was a Freudian war that George Bush wanted to finish a war his father decided not to finish, and that meant getting rid of Saddam.
Stephen Erlanger is the London bureau chief of the New York Times. He was speaking with us from the Times London offices. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The decision to invade Iraq continues to haunt the daily lives of Iraqis. You only need to look back to last weekend in that market in Baghdad where so many people died, 250 at last count. Would that bombing have happened were it not for the invasion? We'll never know for sure. We want to tell you, though, about one of the people who lost their lives in that attack, a man who, despite the violent world around him, was filled with joy and life. He went by the name Adel Euro. He was a rapper and a dancer. Last year, he spoke with the BBC through an interpreter about his passion for dance.
I find myself when I'm dancing. I think I was born to be a dancer.
But Adel Euro said his parents warned him about his dancing in public.
Well, at the beginning when they saw me dancing, they didn't care much. But later when they saw me dancing a lot and doing lots of these moves, they spoke to me and told me that what I am doing could be dangerous in Iraq because this is not our culture. Like, I cannot be dancing in the street or doing these moves outside. So they said that this will bring you more troubles in your life and there is no future for this art or this thing or this hobby you like in Iraq.
Were your parents right that this would get you into trouble?
Yes, they were right. I was once filming in the park, and when I go to the park, I try to find some isolated place where nobody can see me, and I do these moves. Otherwise, I would not do it in front of people. But the police came up, and they said that what I'm doing is a shame and shouldn't be done in public. This is only what women do. So they said, we're going to take you to the police station if you continue.
What did you say to the police?
Well, when they told me they were going to take me to the police station, I told them that what I'm doing is not dancing. It's like a kind of martial arts. And now I'm training and practicing these in public. So I told them this is martial arts and they got it and they accepted this. They said, okay.
Have you done it in public since?
Well, after they told me this, I took my camera. I went home. I stayed home for a while thinking about other alternative places to go and dance there in secret. And again, I went to the same place when there were no people and no police. But I need to be careful every time I go out just not to face these situations again.
Adel Euro wrote on Facebook a few months back that dance was a way for him to turn away from the violence and destruction in his country. In the end, he could not escape it. He was one of the many people killed last weekend in Baghdad. We have a video of Adel Euro's first stage performance up on our website, PRI.org. There are lots of ways to describe Ingrid Betancourt. She's a French-Colombian politician. She's an anti-corruption activist. She was also one of the world's most famous hostages. When she was running for president in Colombia in 2002, she was kidnapped by anti-government FARC rebels. She spent 6 years in Colombia's jungles before security forces rescued her in 2008. Betancourt now lives in Paris, where she's written several books, including a recent novel, The Blue Line. Today, she was here in Boston, so we asked her to drop by our studios to talk about the reaction in Colombia to the recent historic peace pact there. 2 weeks ago, FARC rebels agreed to a ceasefire with the government to end more than 50 years of fighting.
It's a huge, huge event for all of us. I've never seen my country in peace. And especially as a victim, I have to say that there are all kind of mixed feelings coming to this moment. Because, of course, you feel that the ones that are signing the peace agreement are the ones that held you captive for so many years. But at the same time, I think that we all have the responsibility not to give in heritage to the future generations the hatred and the violence we all were victim of. So this is incredible. It's really a very important moment for all of us.
Yeah, so what finally pushed the two sides together, and what lessons can the younger generation take from that so these things are not repeated in the future?
It's difficult to get into the minds of those who are negotiating, but I think that one of the elements that made this possible was the fact that the FARC was really defeated on military grounds. Their historical leaders were killed or died. So it came to the point where they changed the strategy or they would just disappear by disintegration. You know, the FARC is an organization that is, it's like an army. It has a structure, a hierarchy. But it was really very much affected by people coming from the drug trafficking. And that's a tension.
Are you saying they basically didn't have a choice at this point?
If they would have continued like they were, they would have turned only into a cartel.
Mm.
And those who wanted to see the FARC more than a cartel had to make the big decision, and I think they did.
Remind us what the FARC was fighting for, and do you think they won any of what their goals were in the jungle?
The beginning of the FARC in the 1960s is a fight for recognition. In Colombia, people that have nothing are subject to the violence of those who have. By the means of corruption or the means of gun, they will push peasants away from the land and they will just expropriate or steal their land. So these guys took arms in order to defend themselves. But of course, after 60 years, it became really an army and it became a terrorist group. They would kidnap, they would do drug trafficking, they became a threat for democracy. And little by little, I think that they were dispossessed from their original aim. I think that today it's a chance for them to see if by other means, political means, they can achieve what they were fighting for at the beginning.
And you know this obviously very personally because you were abducted and in captivity for 6 years. Was not easy, to put it mildly, to be in the jungle. Prisoners were chained to one another by the neck. You contracted malaria, very little to eat. But at other moments, you've said that the FARC showed tenderness and even kind of humanity. What do you think, looking back, does the FARC have a moral compass?
Never tenderness. And as an organization, it was a very rude and rough and inhumane treatment. But of course, in that organization, sometimes you had exceptions. People that would feel that what they were doing was wrong, that had this fight of their consciousness. I think that these people that were the exception made me think that, you know, humans, we're never black and white.
Mm.
We're always fighting for the good in us and between this light and darkness that we all have. And I could see that very powerfully. I could see people in the jungle trying not to get caught by the evil they were producing. So, well, for us, getting out of all that situation meant is recovering the possibility of humanizing each other.
After your release, you filed suit against the Colombian government. You withdrew the suit, but tell us why you went after the Colombian government.
You know, at the time, there was a law that allowed victims of terrorism to ask for reparations.
Mm.
So I did what all my other fellow hostages did. I think that what I didn't understand at the time is that if I was feeling as a victim completely, I mean, I was in the victim mode. I was just out of the jungle. People in my country were seeing me as a leader, and they couldn't understand that I was claiming compensation when they thought I was not a victim. And the compensation I was asking for was an important amount, not on terms of this world where we are, but in terms of Colombian, you know, finances. And Colombia is a poor country, relatively poor country. And not only that, we have 8 million victims. So if all the 8 million victims would have asked what I was asking, it was impossible to.
What were you asking?
I was asking for $5 million. If you put it here, 7 years in the jungle, For example, there are three Americans that were my fellow hostages that have been granted by the American justice $100 million each. So in comparison, of course, it's not much. But in Colombia, they reacted. That's why I withdrew. But I think
you withdrew the suit because of the reaction from the Colombian public.
It doesn't mean that I don't think we have to be repaired. I think there has to be a reparation, and I think the reparation has to involve many things, not only economics. There are other means of reparation. Emotional is one. But this is something that we have to discuss between Colombians. It's an open wound.
Ingrid Betancourt, I really want to know, if you sat down with the people who took you captive, the men who made the decision to steal 6 years of your life, what would you say to them right now if you could just sit across the table from them?
Well, I think we all suffered very, very much. And the only thing that I would hope is that the suffering could be turned into something constructive for my country. So if they're going to be integrating Colombian politics, I would urge them to do what Colombia needs, which is cleaning the system. We can win peace, but we have not won the battle against corruption. And it means thousands of lives that are in danger, kids that won't make it because they will be starving, no medication, no schooling for so many people. So this is the dire situation many of my countrymen live. And I wish that our suffering could just be a down payment in order to have this straight.
What's next for you? Is the campaign against corruption in Colombia enough to make you run for the presidency or any issue?
Look, right now, to be very honest, my priority is my family. That's what I want to be. I wanted to become a mother again. I lost 7 years of presence with my children. Now I have been blessed because I have two grandchildren coming. So this is my priority. And if Colombia needs me, I will always be there for my country.
Congratulations on your grandmotherhood, and thank you for the interview.
Thank you so much.
Ingrid Betancourt was a Colombian presidential candidate who was held hostage by FARC rebels for more than 6 years. Colombia's government and the FARC recently signed a ceasefire. It'll be tough to consolidate that agreement, though, and the current chaos in neighboring Venezuela certainly won't make things any easier. We'll have more on Venezuela's political and economic meltdown coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Remember when kids just played games, you know, out in the middle of the street?
That used to happen a lot in streets all over North America, in all kinds of games, basketball, baseball, hockey. And it doesn't happen as much anymore.
Why some say the tradition of kids' street hockey is under threat in Canada. That's coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Venezuela, there's no other way to describe it. It's a wreck. It's become a country of long lines and severe shortages of food, electricity, and basic necessities. Crime is spiking, and so is the inflation rate, now at 180%, the highest in the world. But I keep wondering, how did this happen? How does such an oil-rich country basically collapse on itself? So I turned to David Smildy in Caracas. He's with the Washington Office on Latin America, a human rights group.
This is the result of 10 years of economic mismanagement. When oil prices were high, the government spent money hand over fist, and worse yet, what they did is they maintained an overvalued exchange rate. And that meant that imports were very cheap. That really led to a long-term decline in local production. Now, oil revenues have dropped, and Venezuela has very little productive capacity, so it can't produce its own food, really, and it doesn't have enough money to import what it needs. And it also has a lot of debts. It actually accumulated debt during the years in which oil is high, so it has to pay these debts. And so it's faced with either defaulting or feeding its people. So far, what it's been doing is making sure to pay its foreign creditors, but it's really been reducing the number of dollars that are assigned to importing food and other basic goods. And so people are really suffering. There's a real contraction in consumption.
So the government, a socialist Marxist regime launched by Hugo Chavez, for some time it seemed to thrive, but now under Nicolas Maduro it's in crisis. When did the mismanagement of the country start, and under whose watch?
Nicolas Maduro inherited a set of policies from Hugo Chavez that were created during the good times. He's basically taken a model that was already unsustainable when he took office. He's ridden it for 3 years without change. He's riding it right off the cliff. You know, so things have just gotten to a completely atrocious economic situation.
So trying to sidestep the government's missteps, talking about food again, because that really seems to be an indicator of just how bad things are, these groups called bachaqueros, what does that word mean? Who are they and what do they do?
Bachaco is a carpenter ant which carries big loads on its back. And so bachaquero is the name that people give to people who, as their way of making a living, wait in lines and buy whatever goods they can and then sell them on the parallel markets. This is a situation that has actually, in a certain way, made the crisis tolerable over the past year and a half or so, in that allowed a lot of people that were underemployed or unemployed to make many times the minimum wage. And so I think that's what kind of kept a lid on the crisis. Mm-hmm. But it's actually quite an interesting policy. But the government sees this as sabotage, and so it's tried to clamp down on this bachaquerismo. And what it's done is instead it's promoted these things called the CLOPs, which are the Committees on Local Production and Supply, which bring bags of food directly to people. And
so it's kind of the government's own version of the bachaqueros.
Yeah, but the difference is that they bring things. It's a way of trying to circumvent the informal market. The real problem is that there's just not enough food. It's not a distribution problem. It's a production problem. And so what these CLOPs have done is they've just taken a part of the merchandise off of the market from supermarkets, and they distribute it directly. And so that's caused a lot of discontent in the past 2 months among people that now wait in lines for 7 or 8 hours and oftentimes don't get anything. And that's what's led to a number of the lootings and protests that we've seen in the past several weeks.
Would you say the bachaqueros and the CLOPs are actually in some ways making the food crisis worse?
I think that most participatory systems this government puts in place, there's just a lack of control, there's a lack of transparency, they're ripe for corruption, for politicization, and they're just extremely inefficient. So I do think that the CLOPs are making the situation worse. The only thing that would really make the situation better is if the government changed its policies and you had more products coming in and more local production.
How has it been for you finding food?
I'm here doing research. I've traveled to the U.S. about once a month. And so I bring back suitcases full of everything from toilet paper to dish soap to laundry soap. So we don't wait in a whole lot of lines. And what we don't bring in, we can buy on the parallel market, which, after all, is often cheaper than the goods I bring from the United States. The problem is that there's a lot of people who are poor, whose salaries are completely behind. A salary for a university professor at the black market rate would be less than $50 a month. And so those are the people that are really suffering.
What's it feel like for you when you see, you know, your counterparts, academics, waiting in long food lines?
It's a terrible thing to see, and my heart really goes out to them. And it's one of the reasons that keeps me working on this issue. It's not just my colleagues that are here, but it's also extended family that is here. And so it's a really worrying situation. There's not a night that I don't think about this, you know, what's going to happen in the next 6 months, because things are really ugly right now, but they could get significantly worse.
David Smildy in Caracas. He's with the Washington Office on Latin America. He's also a professor at Tulane in New Orleans. David, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you for your interest.
Violence and crime are a big concern in Brazil, too. Gun violence is such a huge issue there that Amnesty International has come out with an app that lets people track violence on their phones. It's called Crossfire, and Amnesty is releasing it just in time for the Olympic Games getting underway in Rio next month. Reporter Catherine Osborne says Rio is one of the most violent cities ever to hold a Summer Olympics, and it's not just the gangs doing the killing.
An extraordinary number of killings in Rio are also by police, so it's important to note that 15% to 20% of homicides in the city of Rio are by police officers, and police homicides have been on the rise as well, especially in the month of May. It was particularly bad.
So Amnesty International has created this app called Crossfire. I gather it's supposed to track violence. How does it actually work?
You log into the app, and if you've heard a shootout or if you've received news of a shootout and somebody has been wounded or killed, you can register it on the app and you can say where it happened and reports of people wounded or killed. And then Amnesty compares all those numbers with other reports and makes records of where the shootouts have been in the city and sort of who is dying over the course of months and even weeks. And what's interesting is that it's something that residents already track on social media. When there's a shootout going on in a neighborhood, a lot of people will post, you know, avoid this area, shootout on this street. But data is available, at least from the government, only to the police themselves, not to residents, about like over a long period of time, which areas have been the most dangerous, et cetera. So this is an effort for citizens to be able to track this more closely, to be able to alert each other where to avoid, and also look at longer term numbers about, in the long run, you know, where is the situation really tense and can we advocate for better police policies in this particular neighborhood?
Sounds like Amnesty International created this for residents of Rio and for greater transparency.
Exactly. And for police as well, not just residents of neighborhoods where shootouts are going on. Killings of police are also on the rise this year, and they too are also the victims when escalation happens between drug gangs and police, which is a big factor in the rise in homicides.
Have you downloaded the app, Catherine?
I have, and I haven't registered any shootouts near my neighborhood, but I have heard from the person who's doing the data entry that since the app was rolled out one day ago, there's been at least two big shootouts in the city, and one police officer died in the north zone of the city. So that's part of the first day totals.
I mean, data is important, but how much can an app actually prevent police brutality and gun violence?
It can be used to help advocate for better oversight of problem areas. And Rio was the center of a big effort at police reform starting in 2008, a program that was primarily for the population, but also meant to secure the city pre-Olympics called Pacification was launched then. There's been a lot of problems with the program, but it's going better in some areas. And so it's a tool where people can really say, look, we have the information that even though you promised sweeping investments in this community, instead, the main thing that's been happening here is shootouts.
So during the games themselves, Catherine, do we know what measures the Rio police are planning on taking? Will they be doing anything dramatically differently?
So the police will be cooperating with the army and also plenty of international security forces. The defense minister recently announced that 220,000 soldiers will deploy to Rio for Olympic security. There are plans to shut down traffic lanes and to isolate athletes and tourists from the rest of the city. And in addition to the big increase of officers in the city, there's also a rise in surveillance, which has also caused concern from civil liberties groups. So yesterday, three journalists were detained for filming subway guards who harassed teenagers coming out of a demonstration. So the city's going to be sort of on high watch and on high alert.
What kind of People's Olympics will that actually make?
That's the biggest critique about the games here, that it'll be safe for the tourists. However, the price that the local population have had to pay for that to happen is high. A lot of people here say disproportionately high. And, you know, for tourists themselves and for the question of, oh, am I going to be safe? They'll probably be fine if they are street smart and they sort of don't walk with their iPhone in front of them taking pictures, as tempting as that is. But I think also thinking about this question of security is a chance for people to engage with the history of Rio, and inequality is a big part of the history here. Rio was one of the biggest slave ports in the Western Hemisphere. And the traces of that you can still see in Brazilian culture in so many ways. And it's Black Brazilians, both in poor neighborhoods and who are police officers, who are making up the majority of those homicide numbers in the city that we're talking about rising. It's likely them who are going to pay more than the tourists.
Reporter Catherine Osborne in Rio de Janeiro. Thanks very much for filling us in, Catherine.
Thanks, Marco.
The World's Will Carlos is also following the run-up to the Rio Olympics. He's put together a list of seven bad omens looming over them. And it's hard to tell what's worse, the killing of Juma, the Olympic mascot, or athletes being mugged in broad daylight. Anyway, we have that list at PRI.org. Remember Ukraine? There's a war in the eastern part of the country still. Started a couple of years ago, Crimea got annexed by Russia. And today, fighters with the self-declared Donetsk People's Republic continue to battle Ukrainian soldiers. Ukraine wants Donetsk to remain with Ukraine, not go the way of Crimea. But Donetsk wants autonomy, and it's backed by Russia on that. Nick Schifrin reports from inside the Donetsk People's Republic about the return of the Soviet tradition of youth squads.
In the Donetsk People's Republic, training for war starts young. Teenage girls in Russian military uniforms spend Saturday afternoons in an empty school taking apart Russian Kalashnikovs. The average Russian soldier needs more than 10 seconds. 15-year-old Katerina, who declined to give her last name, needs 9 seconds.
You really enjoy this. What is it about this that you enjoy so much?
Since I was little, I preferred playing football with boys to playing with dolls. This is our history. We remember our history. We remember who we are.
Who they are today are young Ukrainians who want to separate from Ukraine and join Russia. Their history, according to their leader Sergei Fomchenko, is remembering Ukraine used to be Soviet and reviving the Soviet tradition of each city creating its own youth squad.
Since Soviet times, the military and patriotic education of school children was a priority to cultivate love of school, motherland, and city.
The war here started 2 years ago when hundreds of thousands of pro-European Ukrainians in the capital Kiev threw out the pro-Russian government. In response, pro-Russian residents in eastern Ukraine and Donetsk along the Russian border seized government buildings. Russian troops entered Donetsk and helped local fighters repel Ukrainian soldiers. And today, Donetsk is largely separate from Ukraine. Again, Sergei Fomchenko.
Ukraine split into two parts. We loved our city and our region and kept loving it. The whole eastern Ukraine is closer to Russia. That's how it's always been. Those who stayed here, they want to be part of Russia. I would like us to be part of Russia.
When the girls aren't training, they're proselytizing. They walk through the town square, passing out Donetsk military recruiting flyers to fighting-age males. In this case, anyone between 18 and 55. The girls are guarded by local police officers wearing Russian uniforms.
You're smiling. Why do handing out these flyers make you happy?
I can't serve. I'm too young, and we're not in a state of martial law now, so there's no mobilization of women. This is how I can make a contribution. First and foremost, a man defends his motherland, his home, his family, and only then comes all the rest.
But the more the region around Donetsk isolates itself from Ukraine, the more these teenagers' futures become uncertain. There are no working banks. The best salary in town is a soldier's, $225 a month. Katerina stops to hand flyers to 17-year-olds Vadim Bezi and Alexander Garaykin.
You guys are almost done with high school. What are your job prospects once you graduate?
Right now, there's no prospects here.
The best option in terms of opportunities is to go abroad, for example, to America or England, and find companies there.
But that's impossible because they're physically stuck. Because of checkpoints, they can't leave Donetsk to get Ukrainian passports, and their Donetsk IDs allow access only to Russia. None of that matters to Katerina. Ukraine and Russia might have agreed Donetsk should eventually reintegrate into Ukraine, but she and almost everyone here rejects that because of what this war has forced them to see.
Would you ever be willing to go back to Ukraine?
I don't know. After what I've lived through and what my family lived through, I don't think so. There was a shell in my apartment block. Everything was blown up. We were running away with my whole family. When someone you know gets injured or killed, it's very hard to keep going. When you just saw him and 2 minutes later you're told he's no longer there, it's very hard.
Sometimes it's hard to remember these girls are teenage girls. One of them holds up a flag with their logo, a red stiletto, over an AK-47. They may giggle, but these days they identify more with the firearm than the footwear. For The World, Nick Schifrin, Donetsk.
Nick's stories from Ukraine are supported by a grant from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Tomorrow, he reports on Ukraine's other war, the war against corruption.
There are a lot of people with a huge experience who worked in this country after the collapse of Soviet Union. But what did they achieve? What are the results? The most corrupt customs in the Eastern Europe, guys? I don't think that that's something to be proud of.
We'll meet the woman who cleans the very corrupt customs house at the port of Odessa. That's tomorrow here on The World. If you grew up in Canada, that might be a familiar sound. Street hockey is a way of life for kids there. Or maybe I should say was, because grabbing some old hockey sticks, a ball, and maybe some soda cans to mark goals out in the middle of the nearest street may be an endangered sport. Many Canadian cities now ban or at least discourage kids from playing in the street. It's mostly a safety concern. Writer Colin Horgan understands that, but he still mourns the demise of Canadian street hockey.
I mean, this is a problem in all kinds of places, but it goes back to kids being not really encouraged to use the street as a space to play. And so the street itself has kind of become a no-go zone for children. And so when kids are out there playing, suddenly people become very concerned and very annoyed and that there's some noise in the street. And so they call a bylaw officer, and the bylaw officer comes around and tells them to get out of there. And it just is sort of this, like, this weird cycle of, you know, you're allowed to be in the street, but not really.
Street hockey offers children something that almost nothing else does, ownership of space in the city. Those are your words, Colin.
Yeah.
Why is ownership for kids of their city space important, do you think?
Well, I think some of the people I talked to about this, you know, told me that kids, if they're allowed to own a play area and own a space where they make the rules, you know, if you're playing a game, a pickup game, baseball or hockey, you have to sort of figure out what the limits are. And if you're very good, you kind of have to temper your talent sometimes so that other kids won't pick up their balls and leave. I mean, so instead of an adult designating what the rules are and telling you what you can and cannot do, it's up to children to sort of create their own world, basically. And that used to happen a lot in streets all over North America in all kinds of games, basketball, baseball, hockey. And it doesn't happen as much anymore because a lot of the time kids are now spending more and more time being instructed by adults in some sort of space, whether that is at school or whether that is in organized programs outside of school. And so what's lost in that is a sense of ownership over, well, a sense of sort of self-control that kids can be kind of in control of their own world or their own space or their own rules. And that sort of helps them later in life. It allows you to carry that sense of control over your own situation.
What do you remember most about playing street hockey? And is it too much to say it gave you some important life lessons?
Yeah, of course it did. I mean, when I grew up in Alberta, every Saturday morning during the summers, a bunch of us would meet at the end of the road and play. And I would say that, yeah, probably it did. I wouldn't have known it at the time that it was giving me these life lessons, but all those things applied. You know, having to make the rules and figure out even where the goals are and how far apart they're going to be and where the boundaries are. And if some kids played organized hockey, they had to, you know, not be quite as good as they could have been so that everybody else could kind of have fun. And I think that whether you know, you don't know it consciously as a kid that this is what's going on, but you know, you're learning by playing and, you know, having fun is the best way to learn. If there's an adult standing there telling us what the rules were or saying that was a goal or that wasn't, or, you know, you can't do this or that and had not left it up to us, nobody would have played. It would have been terrible. What would have been the point?
You know, I always figured street hockey was a great proving ground for ice hockey. Doesn't the NHL mm-hmm. or any of its players represent street hockey?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are organized sort of people have taken it upon themselves to organize tournaments of like ball hockey, but again, it's all organized. And so it's not quite the same. Hockey Canada did a survey a few years ago. And one of the top reasons that kids did not sign up for hockey anymore was because it's not fun. And so the street hockey aspect of that, you know, it gives it back, right? It gives kind of that joy back to the sport. And if I were the NHL or if I were an organized hockey, you know, bigwig in this country, I would worry about that. I would think that maybe we should be encouraging more street hockey and more sort of unorganized play in the streets to bring that life back to the sport a little bit.
Sounds like you'd let your kids play.
I would absolutely say, you know, be careful, don't get hit by a car, but, you know, be reasonable and hope for the best. I mean, what else can you do?
Colin Horgan in Toronto telling us about the demise of street hockey across Canada. Colin, thanks so much for your time.
No problem. Thank you.
Finally today, C.W. Stone King is an Australian who loves the blues, but not just any old blues. He loves the blues that many point to as a source of the sound, Mississippi Delta blues.
I roll like thunder, go like dynamite, all flesh and bone I come.
Stone King was a kid when he first heard this music. He grew up in what he calls the ancient eroding landscape of Central Australia. The voices and musical textures created by American bluesmen like Son House and Charlie Patton, updated by Screamin' Jay Hawkins, seemed right at home in his barren homeland. But when Stone King finally visited Mississippi, it wasn't what he expected.
The first time I traveled through Mississippi, I was kind of surprised. It was really at odds with the imaginative world that I'd set these sounds into.
In the end, C.W. Stone King decided the blues seemed to fit his ancient eroded landscape of Australia, but he also has to contend with his accent when he sings. After all, imagine a blues lick with a voice that sounds like Crocodile Dundee.
I'd sing in an American accent because it makes a shape, it fills out a melody that has been created in that sort of dialect. If I was to sing it in a broad Australian accent, it would be very flattened out. The corners wouldn't be filled down to the ends, you know what I mean? It'd be like wearing gloves that are too big for you.
There's a long history of foreign bands singing with American accents, partly to hit the American market, and partly, no doubt, to create some authenticity with what American music sounds like. But even when Stone King's accent reaches perfection, I like to think that I can hear that ancient eroding landscape showing through. But when you hear this zombie rocking slow, till the break of dawn in the Congo, ain't gonna lay to rest till the morning light, gonna raise some sand in the dead of night. Now, C.W. Stone King readily describes his music as hokum, a style of blues with deep roots in the vaudeville and minstrel shows of the 1920s and 30s. When we spoke, I didn't ask about that, but it seems important, so I sent him one final question via email, essentially, how do you see this history of minstrel shows in relation to your own music making?
Yeah, I don't even think about that when I'm making a song. It's not part of my creative process to sift through the multitudes of politics and just people acting bad. You know, you do the best you can do as a human being and as an artist, and that's about all you can do, no matter if you're doing blues or whatever it is.
You do the best you can do. Back Porch Philosophy. You can find that in the Mississippi Delta or the ancient eroding landscape of Central Australia. I got the blues all about. Ain't no telling what we's gonna do. Can't stop that feeling. We'll leave you with more of C.W. Stone King's just-released album, Gone Boogaloo, from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH. Here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you tomorrow. Mama got the blues.
PRI, Public Radio International.